This is Core Christianity. We're answering your questions about the Christian life Monday through Friday. Your hosts are author and seminary professor Dr. Michael Horton and Pastor Adriel Sanchez. Call right now with your question at 1-833-THE-CORE. That's 1-833-843-2673. And now here's Adriel Sanchez.
It's good to be back together again here at The Core with Professor Michael Horton. I'm Pastor Adriel Sanchez. Thank you for listening in. We're excited to have our friend back, David Zoll.
Yeah.
And we're going to be talking about the religion of technology. I read a book some months back called Homo Deus by atheist historian Yuval Noah Harari. He says something really, the whole book is about how humans are progressing to this place where we're essentially going to deify ourselves. We're going to become godlike. And he says, we're getting to the point where, quote, you could buy for yourself the strength of Hercules, the sensuality of Aphrodite, the wisdom of Athena, or the madness of Dionysius, if that's what you're into. Up till now, increasing human power relied mainly on upgrading our external tools. In the future, it may rely more on upgrading the human body and mind, or on merging directly with our tools. Technology has really come a long way, but can it make us godlike? And you've written a little bit about technology in your book, Feculosity. Let's dive right in.
Yeah, I don't think you can really talk about everyday life and with any kind of depth without talking about technology, because people are so tethered to their phones, and it's hard to talk about technology critically without sounding like what a Luddite, and that is sort of a real, a really bad thing in a lot of sectors. And yet, I'm not a Luddite. I run a ministry that has used a lot of online, marshaled a lot of online resources, and I really think that a lot of the ways I know people that I'm great friends is through technology. So I need to kind of say that up front, that technology is sort of a neutral thing.
Yeah.
I think it can be used in different ways. And when it's used as a vehicle or a tool for self-justification, to constantly be asserting or claiming or leveraging your enoughness, your righteousness from the world, well, then it can become very destructive, is the only way to say it. I think that the relationship we have with our phones and the internet has changed the game in a lot of ways. While for people who are interested in the dynamics of the human soul and how we clamor for justification and see that as central to the human, basically, identity and as a sinner, is that you're constantly trying to justify yourself on your own two feet. Well, if that's where we are, if you're that kind of a person, well, then it's a massive opportunity where we can see technology is a way that we distract ourselves from bad feelings or feelings of condemnation, but it's mainly an affirmation machine, a way that I can put out into the world some sort of vision of myself, image of myself, that can then get some love or some approval.
Likes, at least.
Likes, at least. Everything's likes.
And, you know, that's the thing. What you're talking about makes so much sense when we're actually using terms today like, how many likes did you get? I mean, this is not, you're not making this up. People are looking for justification. Anybody who says that the doctrine of justification, God's declaration that we are righteous because of Jesus Christ, anybody who says that doctrine is no longer relevant, it's not a doctrine that people should be interested in our age, obviously have never really thought about the ways in which they are seeking self-justification through, social
Instagram
approval. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, in fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book was it felt I'd heard from usually people within the church who would say, justification, that's antiquated. That's a 16th century question, or that was important then, but now we need to talk about X, Y, or Z. And
how to be affirmed.
How to be affirmed. You want to say, well, listen, have you used a phone ever? Have you been on Facebook or have Instagram, or basically have you been alive? And maybe there was a time when people were less interested in this. I don't know of it, but right now, I feel like for folks who believe that this is the central thrust, God's declaration, his gift of righteousness to the sinner, that simply could not be more trenchant in a world that is basically drunk on its self-justification. You know, we all know what this is like. I can talk to 15-year-olds and the lights go on. But, you know, the people that signed up for Facebook in the last 2 years, the largest demographic was, I think, between the ages of 75 and 85.
Wow.
So it's not a young person's problem. Mm-hmm. It's not a rich person's problem. It's everywhere.
Yeah. What is transhumanism? Adriel was just referring to Harari's book. Why do you think that it's actually a religious idea?
Sure. Transhumanism is the merging of machine and human and technology with humanity in a way to sort of prolong and optimize life. You know, science fiction has been talking about this forever in terms of cyborgs mm-hmm. and Cylons and things like that. But here you have a very active community with a lot of money behind it. Mainly sort of the cliche is that it's based in Silicon Valley, but the attempt is to prolong life to actually indefinitely. Immortality is really the end goal here. And
you just get your parts replaced. You become more and more a machine, right?
You get either maybe you get uploaded to the cloud in some way, but yes, to live forever, to be in complete control
salvation
of everything. I mean, what it is godlike. You know, as with all of this stuff, I think that we think that the gods of sort of Silicon Valley came down from the mountaintop and handed us these gifts and smartphones and everyone took them up. But then we realized 10 years later that they were curses,
yeah.
You know.
Mm.
And that is almost universally acknowledged as true at this point, that there's been some massive downsides to our very quick adapting smart technology.
Which the Silicon deities knew themselves, which is why they didn't give their own kids a smartphone.
Yeah, that's the great wake-up call, isn't it, Mike, that a lot of these executives more and more don't allow their kids to use their own products. And again, the attempt here is not to be purely negative, because a lot of this technology has done some great things.
Sure. We use it all the time.
I can FaceTime with my kids when I'm gone, and that's actually mm-hmm. really great. I can be in touch with my aunt going through chemo. These are wonderful things. But when my only experience of life is through heavily mediated versions of myself and other people,
yeah.
You start to believe that you're only loved or only valuable according to the number of likes you got or approval or feedback. As we know, that can be really, really oppressive.
You know, speaking about the transhumanism stuff, we have actually a call that I want to listen into, see, get your take on this.
Hi, I'm Mackenzie from LA, and I was reading the other day about how Elon Musk started that Neuralink thing where he can like implant threads deep into the brain to let you like read and write like a ton of information. And I was wondering, if AI brain implants become a reality, like if he can actually pull that off, would it be simple to get one?
Well, gosh, I do think they're going to be a reality. I think this sort of thing is coming, and probably faster than we realize. And that maybe makes me sound alarmist.
I put my name on the list to get one of those brain implants. Yeah.
I mean, you never know. There could be some great things about them. I have a feeling that human beings being what they are, we will find a way to not only turn ourselves into machines, but to use them inhumanely against other people. I mean, I don't think there's anything in the Bible about brain implants, but I do think that it's okay to be a creature who is limited and that
who dies. The brain, once it becomes this mechanical, this machine-like, is it really human anymore? Once you're talking about this much augmentation to prolong life, you're no longer talking about prolonging the life of a human being. The person whose life is prolonged is actually now a laptop.
That's true. That's scary. I mean, the further you get into these discussions, the wilder they get. And I sometimes think that for all of these innovations that our friends in Silicon Valley have given us, they don't seem to have read much science fiction, because most of it's about how this goes terribly wrong. And it's a conjecture, but you want to say, well, I think the human imagination is both glorious in its ability to imagine how wrong it can possibly go, but it's nonetheless, I don't know. I think a lot of it is premised on the fact that death is final. And as a Christian, you know, I believe that it's not. I believe life is a veil of tears. And that, in fact, the kingdom come, the second Jerusalem, I mean, that's what I'm kind of excited.
Yeah. Mm. Isn't that, at the end of the day, what it's really about? Two different visions of what life and death mean for us.
I believe it is. Yeah. And people tell you that... even Christians, I think that we've gotten everything is about, when everything becomes about building the kingdom and you know, even personal sanctification, you shrink down the faith to just, you know, the 50 years you're on the planet, rather than seeing this cosmic history of that, you know, where we're talking about heaven and we're talking about hell and we're talking about the life to come. And when we limit ourselves only to the what the imminent frame is, what the word is, or just the here and now, we forget that the hereafter is a big part of the equation. And our hope is really to be found not in the improvement of our lot right now, although that can be great as a response to the gospel, but our hope is to be found in the sort of the new creation.
We don't have our best life now.
No, and I at the end of the book, I actually think that the church would do well to talk a little bit more about death, because
absolutely,
it will be the, I think T.S. Eliot said that the church is the place you go to be reminded of things like sin and death, which you spend the rest of your life, and a lot of with technology, distracting yourselves from or trying to outrun, and in fact, to sort of sit down and to hear about these things, it can be enormous relief, especially when it's in light of the grace of God.
Yeah. And you know, in Scripture, sin and death go hand in hand. We can talk about the eradication or the removal of death through technology, but we don't know how to solve the sin problem. And as long as there's a sin problem, there's going to be a death problem. You know, we might be able to cure all sorts of diseases, but we can't keep people from killing each other or from withholding food and resources. And so it really continually points us back to the hope that we have in Christ. You know, we're not going to solve the problem of death. That's something that Jesus already did, and sin. And unless you solve both of those issues, you're not going to solve either one.
Oh, great point. You say, it makes me sad when religious leaders try to entice people into the pews by means of fresh, religiously sanitized distractions, or when they see it as their missional duty to craft services in which each and every moment is filled with language or light.
Well, I think a lot of what technology does, we've been talking about how it prolongs life. It also distracts. We love it because it distracts us. Amused to death, I think, isn't that Neil Postman's?
Neil Postman.
And boredom has become a thing of the past for a lot of people. If you're sitting in a doctor's office, you know, you start playing Candy Crush, or you can get more work done and you can sort of justify yourself that way. But the church, I think it can either rise to that and try to play by the world's rules and create a more, I don't know, flashy, and this is not a license for the church to be painstakingly boring, but I think that the church can also, in its liturgy, there are pauses and silences, and there are, you know, we are there to receive. And that is a countercultural thing, but I find it a deeply hopeful thing. It's also an embodied space. It's why the internet can never really replace the church. I always joke that you have to be close enough to someone that you can smell them. And it might not be a person you really like. It certainly won't be a person that looks like you. And that's a wonderful thing that we can do. But I think churches, when we try to compete, we miss part of what is such so beautiful about the witness, which is that it's not busy. I remember hearing, I think it was one essayist said that he thought that one of the reasons why secularism or atheism is on the rise is not that people have really thought hard about the claims of Scripture and rejected them, but that they've so distracted themselves that there's no space in which to even address those questions.
Church is a place where we come not to have more distractions from the truth, but to come away from the distractions to hear the truth.
Yes.
And to be with others who are similarly shaped by that truth.
Which is why it can be such a, I guess, ironic or kind of tragic thing when the church is seen as like it's painted as a crutch or another way to distract you from your insufficiencies, when the testimony of most Christians I know is that you go to church and you're reminded of reality, all the buffers that you spend 9 to 5 your week erecting from reality are stripped away, and for a moment, maybe something breaks in.
You're listening to The Core right now, and we're with David Zoll, author of Seculosity, answering questions about the Christian faith. I'm Pastor Adriel Sanchez, and we're also, as always, with Professor Michael Horton. You know, one of the most important things for us as parents is teaching our children about the faith, Jesus. So we have a special offer that we want to let you know about today.
Yeah, we're excited about this helpful resource on corechristianity.com. And if you haven't looked at it, I'd encourage you to just take a look. This one's called 5 Ways to Help Your Kids Keep the Faith, and it's free when you sign up for our weekly newsletter. Adriel and I are dads, and I know a lot of you out there are moms and dads listening to us. What troubles us or makes us more interested in studying the scriptures ourselves than the condition of our kids growing up in this world that we live in right now? This is a practical, down-to-earth resource. It's not comprehensive, of course, but I think you'll find some really helpful wisdom here. Head on over to corechristianity.com/offers to download it.
You can also give us a call at 1-833-843-2673 for help getting a hold of any of the resources that we offer you every day. David, there's a question I want to get to that I want to hear your answer to. Let's listen in.
Hi, this is Brianna. I'd like to know how much time you think I should limit my kids' screen time to. Some of my friends don't let their kids watch any TV, while others will let their 2-year-olds play on their iPhone. So what's your take on that?
Good question.
My gut level is whatever screen time allows you to not hate your child.
Yeah.
I kid. I think that this is another major source of guilt for parents today. Mm-hmm. Perhaps rightly so, but I also know that if you're a parent who is even asking these questions, it says that you are at least conscientious enough to be the sort of parent that loves their child. So yes, there are different takes on this, and I do think, you know, you can look at science, but, you know, the studies keep coming back with different things every time you go to it about technology and kids and how it rewires their brains or how it doesn't. But I know that parents are inundated with so many shoulds and to-dos about this and where everything seems to be at stake that my sense is that you're a better parent if you don't hate your child. And if you need to pacify them a little bit with something, that's okay. I also think if that's all you're doing, maybe you look at why you feel you need to pacify your kid all the time or why you never want to spend time with them. But I don't think there's some proper amount here.
Well, and you're talking again about going beneath this. If you are letting them watch indiscriminately, then, as you say, what's the deeper issue here? At the end of the day, doesn't it come back to what are you finding your ultimate satisfaction, joy, and salvation in? If it's in your work, your child is a distraction to you, then you've got the problem here of seculosity. You've got the problem here of putting your faith in idols. That's the problem, not that you went over your allotted time of screen time.
Yeah, and if you're bought into the seculosity of parenting, where you feel that you are to blame or to be praised for absolutely everything that happens to your child, then and you better not get it wrong, well, then you're going to be absolutely anxious all the time about their technological use, and you might as well move to Amish country because everything becomes a control thing. So there's ways you could fall off the tracks on both sides. And I think that you're absolutely right to figure out what's going on beneath it. Why do you not want to spend time with your kid? Or why do you think that they can't handle a little bit of screen time?
No. You say that work may be our single most enthralling replacement religion. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that in America, at least, which is my context, it might not be everyone who's listening to this context, but the American dream is that when people ask you sort of what you do, they just assume, or if you say, have you led a successful life, you assume that you're talking about your career. Mm-hmm. And not, oh, well, I've spent time with the people I've loved and maybe you'll get there. But I think from the very beginning, there's this idea that we can bootstrap our way to heaven And so it's very much affirmed. You know, I point out in the book that America leads the world, the developed world, in sort of the least amount of required vacation days. Mm. But we also lead the world in the most untaken vacation days. We don't have many vacation days to begin with, and we're not even taking those. That, to me, betrays an element of pathology around our relationship with work, that work is somehow a respite from other less manageable realities in life, or it is a place where we are looking to work. Let me just put it this way. We are looking to work for purpose, for meaning, not just for compensation, but for purpose, for meaning, for community. And oftentimes for identity, and we're looking to work for our career to a lot of the things we once looked to God for. Mm-hmm. This, again, is not a way to say that work or career is bad or in fact, even enjoying what you do. But it is not the sole indicator of your value.
Yeah.
On the flip side, David, how do we turn even leisure and rest into a replace? I mean, it seems like we it's either one or the other, you know? We're either turning leisure and rest into religion, or it's our work.
Well, I read an article last year, I think, saying that people don't have hobbies anymore, that their hobby stores are going out of business. Hobby stores is usually a euphemism for, like, basically model train shops. But the idea is that what I do in my free time is, well, I'm running, and I'm not just running, I'm training for a marathon. Oh. Or I'd like to do woodworking in my shed, aka now, and I've decided I'm going to remodel our house.
Yeah.
And so we've turned all of our leisure pursuits into
more work,
and they become a more measurement. I'm part of a biking club because we're training for a triathlon instead of just I like to go biking.
Mm-hmm.
So leisure to me is kind of whatever you do for its own sake, just for the enjoyment of it. But in an atmosphere of seculosity, it becomes only important to the extent that it improves your overall score in life. And so instead of making a contribution at the office, you're making a contribution, you know, on the rowing machine or whatever it is. So this is very telling that they'd have figured out the only way to sell Americans on sleep technology, because right now sleep technology is huge. Sleep hacking, it's called. These incredible mattresses, there's been an explosion of mattress companies, and they figured out, the reason this happens is because they finally figured out how to sell Americans on sleep. Not to tell them it will help them rest if you have a better pillow. It's to tell them that they will be more efficient at work.
Huh.
Sleep, which is the exact opposite of work, has become completely indentured to achieving more.
Wow.
And that's a very strange situation. And so now you have something called orthosomnia, where people stay up all night worrying about if they're not sleeping well enough. I mean, that's
Wow.
You get orthorexia, too, with food, but it's a strange situation in which there's rest is not valuable in and of itself. It's only constitutive of work.
Wow. What would you say to somebody listening right now who's saying, I get what you're saying, and it's interesting theory, but I don't see the point. You have to work to make a living. You have to have a family, even if it's, you know, not a wife and kids. You have friends. You have a neighborhood that you look out for. We have technology. This is the world we live in, David. Are you trying to make us feel guilty now for the fact that we work so hard and we have technology and we have responsibilities to our families and so forth?
Well, I want to say that I am the chief of sinners here. I'm a workaholic, and I have a terrible relationship with my phone. I have no leg to stand on as a person you should put faith in. Let me say that very clearly. I would say, though, that what drives me to God and to the cross is basically the failure of all of those projects to justify me, or at least to save me. And there's plenty of room at the foot of the cross, my friends. This is not another thing for you to feel guilty about. You already feel guilty. That's what the book is trying to say. It's where do we go with that guilt? Do we double down on our careers? And I get there are so many economic realities that are tough. I was just hearing about the housing market in Southern California, and I just don't think that's all that's going on. I think there's also a sense in which we are looking to these things for what only God can provide.
Thanks for listening to Core Christianity. To request your copy of today's special offer, visit us at corechristianity.com and click on Offers in the menu bar, or call us at 1-833-843-2673. That's 833-THE-CORE. When you contact us, please let us know how you've been encouraged by this podcast. And be sure to join us next time as we explore the truth of God's Word together.